everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on famine coming to America right after this. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton, a very prominent journalist in New York City back in the 1880s, said this. He said, "There's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with. And others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write an honest opinion would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes." Unquote. Now, that's quite a statement. These rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program in this New World Order. They are the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys, the Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send your email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Famine. Famine in the United States of America? It's preposterous, you say. I agree. When we Americans talk about famine, we don't talk about famine in the United States. We talk about famine relief in Ethiopia, Chad, and Niger. What are we Americans going to do with our grand and great surpluses that we can distribute free of charge to those underdeveloped third world nations over in Africa or Asia that are suffering from drought, locusts, or some other natural calamity, or war, or something else? The concept of having a famine in the United States of America is preposterous on its face. Let's face it. Americans eat so well that 27% of us are overweight or obese. We don't have a food problem in America, but it's coming. And in the Bible, the word famine appears quite often. In fact, it appears 101 times. It appears in four forms: famine, singular, famines, plural, famish, and famished. 101 times. And we're all pretty familiar with the story of Joseph and the seven-year famine in Egypt. You know, we heard about that in Sunday school, if you'll remember. And then when we look at Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, those two penal clause chapters, we see not only famine, but cannibalism. Now, I don't know who these people are that are going to be reduced to cannibalism, but I think we ought to find out, don't you? It's mentioned in Isaiah 2 times, Jeremiah 30 times, and Ezekiel 13 times. Ezekiel 5 and 6 and Revelation 18:8 have something to say about this thing of famine. And this guy that talks about famine in the Bible, we call him God, you know, normal people just refer to God, or maybe nature, or some other term maybe, but in the Bible there's a guy by the name of God that we normally refer to as the first cause, the creator. And it's been my contention for a long time that this is not the guy you want to be giving the finger to. Because he goes ballistic every now and again. He went ballistic at Sodom and Gomorrah and killed everybody there. He went ballistic at the time of Noah. Remember the story of Noah and Noah's Ark? Killed everybody in the world. And remember the Egyptians when they were pursuing after Moses and the Israelites? And the Red Sea opened up. Actually, it was the Gulf of Aqaba, but you know the story goes. The Red Sea opened up. Moses went through with the Israelites, and the Egyptians followed after him. And God closed up the Red Sea and killed all the Egyptians. Now, that's why I contend that this isn't the guy that we ought to be giving the finger to. And yet, over the past 100 years, we Americans have not only been giving the finger to our God, we ridicule and impugn him, and our 330,000 preachers call him a liar. That's right. We have 330,000 preachers in this country, and not every one of them. There's 10 or 15 preachers here in the United States of America that actually believe God meant what he said and said what he meant. The other 329,985, they all believe that he's a liar. He didn't mean what he said at all. The Bible is scientifically inaccurate, and that it was written by a bunch of nomads with long hair and stringy beards wandering around in the deserts that didn't know their heinies from a hot rock, and that's what they teach us every week in Sunday school and church. Now, that's the story that I got. I don't know about you, but that was my experience from churchianity. Now, with that little bit behind us over here, let's take a look at the secular side, food, land, population of the U.S. economy. And we'll talk about this thing of famine in the United States and the public policy of the United States that ensures that famine is coming to our shores in the same way that oil shortages, a famine of oil, has come to our shores. So before I get started on food, land, and population, let me give you an analogy here. We developed an oil policy in the 1920s and 30s that we followed until we hit peak oil in this country about 1973. Now, that policy had a side effect. It had an ultimate end. Now, it's not that there's any shortage of oil here in the United States. We Americans have been blessed with more oil than any other region, location, or country in the world. Now, you're going to sit there and say, well, my God, Gordon, you've lost your mind. No. Listen, I want to tell you a little story here. In the International Forecaster, Montana's governor, this is this week's International Forecaster, Montana's governor wants to solve America's rising energy costs using a technology discovered in Germany 80 years ago that converts coal into gasoline, diesel, and aviation fuel. And he says Montana can produce gasoline at $1 a gallon. $1 a gallon. Cost per barrel is $32. Montana has 120 billion tons of coal and could supply the entire country with aviation gas and diesel fuel for 40 years without creating any environmental damage. A 22,000 barrel a day plant would cost about $1.5 billion. This is an eye-opener. Let's see what George and the neocons do now. Actually, Montana is not the place where you want to do this. You want to do this in Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. You see, that's where the coal lies. It's in the Powder River Basin and in the oil shale of the Rocky Mountains. We have in this country 3.6 trillion barrels of oil in the oil sands. We have a 660-year supply of coal at today's consumption rates that can be converted into aviation fuel, diesel, and gasoline. The Germans discovered how to do that back in the 1920s. They used it effectively in World War II. They were cut off from petroleum. We're not going to do that. We haven't done that. Our oil policy was liquid oil petroleum, and we would use it until we run out, and then we would go overseas and import the difference. Now, one-third of our balance of payments deficit comes from the importation of oil. We now get 58% of the oil that we use in this country comes from overseas, comes from Venezuela and Saudi Arabia and so on. Not that we have any shortage. It's that our public policy guarantees that we will not develop that which we have. And over time, that public policy has some side effects. And the side effects of our oil policy of the 1920s and 30s are near $700 billion a year trade deficits in our international balance of payments. Now that's public policy. Now when we talk about food, land, and population, we Americans have evolved or elected a food policy in this country. We have adopted the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and every place that communism has been used in the world, it has produced shortages and famines everywhere, without exception. If you know of any place where communism has worked, send me a letter and let me know, would you? Tell me the story. Give me some details so that I can share it with everybody else. But everywhere that this philosophy of abandoning or abolishing private property has been used, to give you another quick example, in the southeastern United States, we produce more timber and timber products there in that region, you know, from Texas over to Georgia and up to Tennessee. More timber and timber products come out of that region of the country than any other region of the country. Even though most of the timber is in the western United States, it's publicly owned. So 90% of the timberlands in the southeastern United States are privately owned and produce more than half of the timber that we use in the United States. And up in the northwest, where the public ownership, that is the communist ownership of our public lands, produces timber, they produce less than half, and they have more than twice as much timber and timber lands as they do in the southeast. But you know, we have a public policy concerning those timber lands in the northwest. And that policy, that public policy, that communist public policy produces less timber and timber products than does the southeastern United States, and they have less than half the land and less than half the timber available. Now, why is that? Why does private property produce more than public ownership? Now, we used to practice in this country in the private property and private ownership. And when the farmland of America was in the hands of small, independent farmers, we had such an abundance, such a surplus in the United States that we developed the farm programs of the 1940s and 50s to deal with these incredible surpluses that we had. We didn't know what the hell to do with all this stuff. We don't have those surpluses anymore, boys and girls. In fact, next year or the year after, the year 2006 or 2007, America will become a net food importing nation. And that's why I said famine is coming to America. It's coming to America because of public policy, not because we're short of land, not because we're short of technology or ability. It's our public policy. The public policy that now gives us $3 a gallon gasoline. The public policy that makes America a net importer of forest products. And a public policy that is going to make America a net importer of food is going to produce famine in America in the same way that we have famine in oil and famine in timber products. Now listen to this. Highlights of food land population in the U.S. economy. The following two pages are highlights of the study, Food Land Population in the U.S. Economy by Dr. David Pimentel of Cornell University and Mario Giampietro of Rome, Italy. This comprehensive assessment of U.S. production growth and its impact on America's agricultural productivity was commissioned by Carrying Capacity Network. It's called CCN, Carrying Capacity Network, a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., which focuses on the interrelated nature of the economy, population growth, and environmental degradation. Here are some of the key findings. At the present growth rate of 1.1% a year, the U.S. population will double to more than 500 million people within the next 60 years. And it is estimated that approximately 1 acre of land is lost due to urbanization and highway construction for every person added to the U.S. population. Now, this means that only 0.6 of an acre of farmland will be available to grow food for each American in the year 2050, as opposed to 1.8 acres per capita available today. At least 1.2 acres per person is required in order to maintain current American dietary standards. Food prices are projected to increase 3- to 5-fold within this period. So whatever you're paying for peanuts today, expect to pay 3 to 5 times that over the next 50 years. And if present population growth, domestic food consumption, and topsoil loss trends to continue, the U.S. will most likely cease to be a food exporter by approximately 2025 because food grown in the United States will be needed for domestic purposes. And since food exports earn $40 billion a year for the United States annually, the loss of this income source would result in an even greater increase in America's trade deficit. Considering that America is the world's largest food exporter, the future survival of millions of people around the world may also come into question if food exports from the United States were to cease. And the U.S. population growth as a primary cause, Drs. Pimentel and Giampietro have concluded that U.S. population growth is a primary cause of these harsh potential outcomes. The study explains that the United States is the fastest growing industrialized country in the world, now increasing by approximately 3 million people per year. This population growth is equivalent to adding 58,000 people per week, or a city the size of Washington, D.C., to our country every year. The overall growth rate of the United States population has escalated in large part because of the unprecedented number of immigrants that have been allowed to come into the United States and their disproportionately higher birth rates compared to the native-born. About half of the U.S. population growth is currently the results of immigration. Now, there is a carrying capacity and consequences to take into consideration. When we look at the land, the ongoing soil erosion and the expanding urbanization contribute to the continuous loss of cropland in the United States annually. More than 2 million acres of prime cropland are lost to erosion, salinization, and waterlogging every year. In addition, more than 1 million acres are removed from cultivation as America's limited arable land is overwhelmed by the demands of urbanization, transportation networks, and industry. As a result of arable land shortages, U.S. meat consumption will have to be reduced. All right, now let me pause right here and let me give you a couple of numbers that we're going to see as we proceed along. If you got a pen and paper and you want to follow along, write this down. We have 414 million acres of cropland in America. So just write down 400 million acres. Under the 400 million acres, we're losing approximately 2 million acres a year just to soil erosion and bad management and bad stewardship of the land. We lose approximately 3 million acres a year to urbanization. That's parking lots and freeways and highways, etc., and housing subdivisions that we're building. Now, that's 5 million acres a year. Now, you take 5 million acres a year over the next 60 years. You know, that's 300 million. That's 75% of the cropland. And where is it that you build your houses, your cities, and your freeways? Well, you ain't building them out in the Rocky Mountains and the Wasatch Mountains. You're building them down on the flatlands, on the cropland. That's where you build your cities. You know, Los Angeles used to be full of orchards. You know, back at the turn of the century. All those orchards are torn out and paved over, and people live there today. That's what you do with your cropland. So don't think now that you're using or you're building your cities out here on the land that is useless or worthless. Primarily, you build on your cropland. That's where you build your cities. Now, there's some problems that are coming from this policy. This is a policy that we Americans use, and there's an end result to it. Now let's take a look at water. The groundwater that provides 31% of the water used in agriculture is being depleted at 160% faster of a rate, 160% faster than its recharge rate. Okay, let me pause here for a moment and explain that one. We have a big aquifer here called the Ogla Aquifer. And you know those big center pivots? Next time you're flying across the country, you look down out of the airplane and you'll see these circles all over down there. Well, those circles are a quarter of a mile. And it's 160 acres. Each one of those circles down there is 160 acres. And they are pumping water out of the groundwater, to irrigate that at a rate 160% faster than the water can recharge that aquifer every year. Now, there's a bunch of water down there. Now, it doesn't take a real smart person to figure out that if you keep doing that, if we knew how much water was down there, we could then begin to figure out how long we're going to take to pump it all out. In Casa Grande, Arizona, in 1930, the water table was at 300 feet, and today it's at 6,000. There's still water there, but they're pumping at 6,000 feet. Now, boys and girls, when it gets down to 60,000 feet, don't you think that's going to pose a real big problem? And the civilization that lived at Casa Grande, Arizona, in the 14th century disappeared because they ran out of water. They used to irrigate down there. And they ran out of water. You got more people in Arizona than Arizona can feed, clothe, and house. It's an arid state. You don't have enough water down there. You have to pump it in. You have to divert it. You have to bring water to those people. That's a public policy. Our public policy is to inhabit the desert places. Well, okay. But if you follow that public policy, those people have to have water. And when you run out of water by taking 160% more, for instance, out of the Ogla Aquifer and out of the Casa Grande Aquifer, at some point in time you're going to run out of water. And when there's no water, those people won't be able to live, at least in that location. They're going to have to migrate. They're going to have to move someplace else. That's going to create quite a migration, don't you think? Okay, now that's one item. The vast U.S. Ogla, that's called the Ogallala, if I can pronounce that, O-G-A-L-L-A-L-A. It doesn't sound this way, but I've heard it pronounced Ogla. Now, this thing here says Ogallala aquifer under Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas will likely become non-productive within the next 40 years. Even if water management is substantially improved, the projected 520 million Americans in 2050 would have about 700 gallons per day per capita, considered the minimum for all human needs, including agriculture. So you got to have minimum 700 gallons a day. Today we have 1,400 gallons. That's double what we need. But over the next 40 years or 50 years, we're going to be down to 700, which is barely what we need. And over the same 40 or 50 year period, the Ogla aquifer is going to be pumped dry. Uh-oh. Did you hear this? This aquifer underlies Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas. Now, some of the prime farmland in America is sitting right here in Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas. Just thought I'd share that with you. Also covers Kansas, and it's a little bit bigger than that. It goes up into South Dakota, too. All right, now, energy. The availability of non-renewable fossil energy explains in part the historically high productivity of U.S. agriculture. Currently, the 400 gallons of oil equivalents expended to feed each American amount to about 17% of all of the energy that's used in this country every year. Yet given current use levels, only 15 to 20 years of oil resources remain in the United States. Although imports now account for 58% of all oil used in the United States, these international reserves are expected to be exhausted within the next 30 to 50 years. Did you notice that this time period over the next 30 to 50 years is aimed at more than one resource? The aquifer's going dry. Oil is peaking, and we're going to be running short of oil. And the population is doubling at the same time that the aquifer's going dry and that the oil's going to be less available. And 17% of the energy that we use in this country goes directly into agricultural production. Now, what's that tell you? I mean, you know, you don't have to be a genius here to start putting these numbers together and says, oh my God. Fortunately for an old man like me, I can sit here with the luxury of saying, well, I won't be here 30 to 50 years from now. So all I'm concerned about is the next 10 or 20 years, and I'm out of it. But what about my children and my children's children? They're going to be here, aren't they? And what kind of a lifestyle are they going to enjoy or will be reduced to because of this public policy that we're following today? And I guess the question arises, as we progress along, we ought to ask the question, well, what public policy should we be following? How should we change that public policy? And I'm just giving you the numbers here. I'm just giving you the facts. These are the numbers that the experts crunch. I'm just a reporter. I'm just giving you the numbers that come out. That's what they're telling us. This has been true, and these numbers have been bandied about over the last 30 years. And experts in the field have been telling us, you know, we've got to make some meaningful changes. Nothing, to my knowledge, has changed over the last 30 years. The pumping of the aquifer has continued on. Population has continued on. The depletion of oil and oil policy has continued unabated. I haven't seen anything change in my lifetime concerning these problems that I'm describing to you right now. Therefore, I find it hard to believe that anybody's going to change anything over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, any more than they changed over the last 10, 20, 30, or 40 years. So one of these days, when all of this comes to fruition, there's going to be a great awakening. And that great awakening is going to be an awakening to shortages. And one of those shortages is going to be food. But is the food shortage and the famine 40 years away? Or is it 5 or 10 years away? Well, we'll talk about that when we come back. Let me give you a reminder right here and tell you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about famine coming to America, of all places. Talking about energy, the availability of non-renewable fossil energy explains in part the historically high productivity of U.S. agriculture. Currently, we Americans use 400 gallons of oil equivalents expended to feed each American. They amount to about 17% of all of the energy used in this country. And given current use levels, only 15 to 20 years of oil resources remain in the United States. And although imports now account for 58% of oil used in the United States, these international reserves are expected to be exhausted within the next 30 to 50 years. And by the way, we're now at peak oil. Now, you can sit there and say, and people write me letters all the time, and they say, well, come on, Gordon, you're nuts. There's lots of oil out there. You're right. I agree. Lots of oil. We Americans have 3.6 trillion barrels of it. But you see, the oil companies that control the underground reserves are not about to start working on oil shale and coal gasification plants as long as they've got one barrel of oil left to pump out of the ground. If you go back to the earlier controversy in the 1850s, America was running low on whale oil, and prices were escalating because of the shortage of whales. Well, when petroleum, underground petroleum reserves were developed, you know, in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, and took over the role of whale oil, the whale oil interests were just fighting tooth and toenail in the Congress to prevent this new technology from taking over. Now, ultimately, in a free marketplace environment, something else will come in. If we were in a free marketplace environment, oil shale and coal would come in to take over, because you see, you can produce the oil shale for less than $60 a barrel, and as the governor pointed out, you can produce gasoline, aviation fuel, and diesel out of coal for around $32 a barrel. Now, we're paying $65 a barrel, I heard the other day, for this imported oil that we're buying. So that being the case, you can rest assured that ExxonMobil is going to be fighting in the halls of Congress until hell freezes over before a single gallon of oil is ever, or coal is ever produced, or gasoline produced from coal or oil shale. Rest assured. That's what public policy is all about. Lobbyists
in Washington, D.C., and the news media and the advertising people are out here propagandizing you and I and telling us that our president's doing a great job with this new energy bill. I don't know what the hell this energy bill was all about. I didn't see anything in there about producing gas out of coal or oil shale. If it was in there, it was buried so deep I didn't see it. Now, that's what public policy is all about. And these public policies are pushed by these major multinational corporations. Food policy in this country is governed by PepsiCo, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Burger King, Heinz. There's about 20 companies, 20 food companies that shape America's food policy. And those multinational corporations are not thinking ahead to the depletion of the aquifers or the loss of oil or the increase in population. They're not making any long-range plans for the future. They're making their plans for corporate profits. All short-term corporate profits. They only think from quarter to quarter. If they think a year or 2 years in advance, that's long-term planning. They work from one quarter to the next. There's four quarters in a year. Now, given current depletion rates of land, water, and energy resources, U.S. agricultural productivity is already unsustainable. Just like oil production. We consume way more oil and oil products than we produce. It's not only that way in this country, it's that way worldwide. Well, there's a point in time when it's going to come to an end. The housing bubble is another one of those things, public policies, that is coming to an end. And there are going to be consequences that come from it. Now, if you've got a $300,000-$400,000 mortgage that you're servicing now with this adjustable rate mortgage, and you're just as happy as a clam at high tide today, you know, making your payments and working your job, you're going to see the side effects of that mortgage come down upon you in future years. If you can't plan ahead, think ahead, and see what's coming 3 or 4 years from now, well, then that's your problem in life. You're going to suffer the consequences of your lack of planning. Same thing is true with oil. I mean, you know, we're suffering the consequences today of this lack of planning. What we should have done in the 20s and 30s is to look ahead and say there's coming a time when liquid petroleum underground is coming to an end. We need to develop a public policy toward developing our vast oil shale reserves. And let's get after it right now. We didn't do that. And so now we're at this crisis. The crisis originally started with peak oil in 1970 here in the United States when we were consuming all the oil that we could pump out of the ground. Well, in the 35 years since then, we haven't done anything to develop that 3.6, that 600-year supply of oil sitting out there in the western states. Not that we couldn't, but that we didn't. And we're not going to, because public policy is formulated by ExxonMobil. It's not formulated by you and I, boys and girls. It's formulated by those multinational corporations that pay for all those lobbyists and buy all of those politicians in Washington, D.C. So when you give the current depletion rates of land, water, and energy resources, U.S. agricultural productivity is already unsustainable. And should the U.S. population double within the next 60 years, the subsequent decrease in arable land will substantially change American eating habits and dramatically reduce future food exports. If Americans want continued access to abundant and affordable food with the ability to continue exporting food, then we must work together to stop U.S. population growth and then conserve our country's limited land, water, and energy resources in order to achieve a sustainable American future. Now, population growth reduces self-sufficiency in food, availability of vital natural resources, and ultimately our standard of living, and ultimately U.S. national security. The United States is in a privileged situation compared to many other nations in the world because its per capita endowment of natural resources is relatively high based upon its current population density. However, the United States is at serious risk of losing this privilege if attention is not given to the control of population growth, including immigration. The sustainable management of natural resources and the development of alternative energy sources, food security depends on ample, fertile land, fresh water, energy, and protecting biodiversity of plant and animal species. Now, native-born Americans are reproducing at about replacement level. However, the overall growth rate of the U.S. population has been escalating during the past decade, in large part because of the unprecedented number of immigrants that have been allowed to come into the United States and their high birth rate. And since the 1950s, the U.S. population has grown from 150 to 260 million. Now, this means that about 3 million people are being added each year, 58,000 a week. About half of this increase results from our liberal immigration policy. And at the present growth rate of 1.1% a year, the U.S. population is going to double to about 520 million over the next 60 years. And such a major expansion will dramatically decrease per capita availability of all of the resources that support human life. Significant changes in food availability, type of diets, food costs, food exports, and food security are certain to follow. And when you consider also that 36 million Americans now live in poverty, and many of those do not have sufficient food, the number in jeopardy continues to grow and gives further evidence that our food situation will worsen as our population grows and all resources, including food, become in shorter supply than ever before. To clarify the extent of the problems concerning land and food supply we surely will face in the year 2050, an assessment is made of the carrying capacity of available land, water, and energy resources, and all vital to achieving an adequate supply of food. Balanced against these are the impacts of a doubling of the U.S. population can be expected to inflict upon these natural resources. Somebody's going to say, well, my God, the Chinese have a billion people on their ground. And if you want to live with the standard of living of the Chinese, when we have a billion people in this country, we too will have their standard of living. Now, the higher standard of living for everybody comes from the abundance of the things that we produce. Now, we Americans are in the process of exporting our jobs, our technologies, and our very lifestyle that we're trying to sustain. For instance, the other day I saw some numbers come in on garlic. Now, garlic isn't a very big industry in the United States. I doubt if they even produce $1 billion a year. But to give you an illustration, it's just one of hundreds of industries that have been exported overseas. Here in the United States, it costs about $16 a pound to produce, to distribute, and to sell garlic in the supermarket. If you buy your garlic from China, you can sell it in the supermarket for $3.65 a pound. Now, there's a big difference between $4 a pound and $16 a pound. You can sell garlic in the supermarket for $16 a pound when you grow it in the United States. Well, now, which would you rather buy, boys and girls? $16 a pound garlic produced in the United States or $4 a pound garlic produced in China? Well, Americans have voted with their pocketbooks and they go to Walmart and they buy the Chinese garlic. And American public policy is free trade. And our public policy is if the Chinese want to sell their garlic in the American market for $4 a pound, then let them have at it. And Americans love it because that's one of the factors that holds down this thing called inflation. Unfortunately, the people that grow garlic in Gilroy, California, have been displaced. People that were producing garlic for the American market either have to produce it at $4, like the Chinese, and reduce their standard of living to that of a Chinaman, or go out of business. So they went out of business. And so the Chinese now have our garlic business, along with our shoe business, along with our television business, and electronics business, and so on. Well, the exporting of 2 million American jobs over the last 4 or 5 years means that you people now are taking poorer and poorer jobs, service industry jobs. In other words, jobs that used to be paying you $15 or $20 an hour are now paying you $5 to $10 an hour. So you're making half as much money, which is okay because you're only paying one-fourth as much for the products that you're buying. And so this lowering of your income requires then that you buy cheaper and cheaper products that are imported, which increases your balance of payments, which has an ultimate side effect as a matter of public policy. It's called trade war. See, the Chinese the other day came over here and said, okay, now we got about $250 billion of your dollars. We sold you a lot of garlic and big screen TVs, and we took your paper, your promises to pay. Now we'd like to trade in those promises to pay and buy an oil company. So they came over and said, okay, we got an oil company and we want to buy it. And we said, no, no, you can sell us garlic and you can sell us big screen TVs and all that good stuff, but no, you can't spend our dollars, your dollars, on oil companies. We won't let you do that. Well, boys and girls, that has a side effect. What that says to the Chinese or says to anybody is that your money's no good here. Well, then if I can't spend my money in your store, well then why would I want to do business with you? Now, when nations get to the point where they don't want to do business with you, that's called trade war. And unfortunately, we Americans are not in a very good position. Our economy is totally dependent upon the Chinese. I don't think that's a very good strategic position to be in. And now you've exported many of your industries, like your shoe industry. Did you boys and girls know that only 1% of the shoes that we consume in America are produced in America? 99% of all shoes sold in this country come from outside our borders. Did you know that? I don't think that's a very good public policy. 58% of all of the gasoline that you people are burning in your cars comes from outside of our borders. I don't think that's a very good public policy. The truth be known, I think that when we Americans produced all of our own oil, produced all of our own shoes, produced all of our own garlic, and employed all of our own people in this country, we had the highest standard of living in the world. And we had the lowest balance of payments deficit. We had a surplus, not a deficit. I think that was better public policy, but that's just my opinion. Now, Americans have voted. Americans have chosen. And I'm just here to report to you that, okay, now that you've made those choices, and now that the Chinese are making your shoes, if they ever decide not to ship shoes, you're going to go barefoot. If they ever decide that you're going to have to pay for your garlic instead of giving them promises on pieces of paper, I mean, you actually got to give them a Caterpillar tractor. I think you're going to find out that America does not produce enough of anything that anybody in the world wants to buy. Now, you can sit there and say, but we Americans are exporting a lot of grain. Oh, no, we're not. We used to. Those exports that this man's talking about, $40 billion, dropped to $26 billion. And they're dropping every year. In fact, they're figuring that by the year 2006, 7, or 8, I mean, just could be next year, the year after that, it's going to be at balance. That we're going to be importing as much as we export in dollar volume. Yeah, we export soybeans, corn, and wheat. Three things. Export those three commodities. We import everything else. We Americans are importing right now half of the food that we eat in this country. Do you really believe that that's good public policy to be importing half of the food that you eat in your country? What happens if you get into a trade war with Mexico and they say kiss off and we're not going to export any more tomatoes? Our tomato industry was destroyed by NAFTA. See, under the NAFTA program over there, we allow Mexicans to send tomatoes into the United States duty free. By doing that, the tomato industry of South Florida was destroyed. See, we have to pay those guys minimum wage, $5 an hour. They only pay them $2 an hour or less down in Mexico. You know, we can't compete with that, not maintain our standard of living. And that's the way it is, you know, with automobiles. You know, you auto workers up in Detroit, you want to get paid $40, $50, $60 an hour, but, you know, that's all well and good. But you're trying to compete with that high wage scale over there with Japanese, whose average wage scaling is around $15 an hour. And then in South Korea, it's $11 an hour. And then you go to China and it's about, I don't know, is it $2 a day? 11 cents an hour, I heard. 11 to 14 cents an hour. And General Motors is moving its Buick operation out of Michigan over to China. So shortly, when you buy a Buick, it's going to be coming from China. These are public policies, boys and girls, and these public policies are dovetailing with famine, because the same public policies that we have followed in our timber products and in our industrial products and in our petroleum products over here, we're following with food. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay, so you're a little short of oil, and they shut off your oil. Well, you know, we probably tough that out. And maybe they shut off our shoes, and maybe we go barefoot. But you know, when they shut off your food over there, boys and girls, then you're about 30 days away from dying. And while, you know, the cutoff of your shoes and automobiles and big screen TVs isn't life-threatening, the cutoff of your food is. I don't think that's very good public policy. Now, we talk about food surplus here in the United States. Let's talk a little bit about surplus, because here's an article called "The Food Surplus, a Staple Illusion of Economics." It's a cruel illusion for populations. In the abstract, disjunction market surpluses of food and worldwide nutritional shortfalls appears to be symptomatic of underlying vulnerabilities, raising questions about the sustainability of agricultural production. When is surplus less than plenty? And how is it true that due to advances in agriculture of many countries, there is now a substantial world surplus of food, while at the same time, more people than ever are undernourished or malnourished? Surplus, in the sense that buyers do not exhaust the supply at any price acceptable to sellers, is standard usage in economics. With food, the term denotes that a few countries have become net exporters of certain foodstuffs, around which there is intense sales competition on the world market. While this is an important consideration for American agriculture, which produces many of those foodstuffs and competes on the world market, it says nothing about whether the world's growing human population can be adequately fed by any likely increases in food production. Used in connection with world population, world carrying capacity, or sustainable production, food surplus is misleading. Or even worse than misleading. Unfortunately, the erroneous connection is widely made, even though it is misleading. Only from the producer's point of view is there a surplus. From many potential consumer standpoint, there is a shortage. Some go hungry even in countries that are net exporters of food. There is surplus largely because millions of malnourished persons do not have the financial wherewithal to create an economic demand sufficient to acquire a nutritionally adequate share. For example, in India, the Green Revolution success story, the National Institute of Nutrition estimated that as many as 50% of rural households and 55% of urban slum households do not have enough food to meet daily energy requirements. Did you get that, boys and girls? half the people in the country and half of the people in the urban slums in India don't have enough food. Doesn't mean that they don't have any. It means that they don't have enough. Well, I guess the question arises, well, how much is enough? I had a guy come in here one time. He said, "Hey, Gordon, you know, you charge too much money for your classes." And I said, "Well, how much is enough?" And he said, $100. And I said, "Well, how much does my phone bill cost?" And he said, "I don't know." I said, "How much does it cost to produce the paperwork that associates with these classes?" He says, "I don't know." I said, "What's the overhead and the cost of travel associated with this business?" And he said, "I don't know." So my conclusion was, and I asked the guy, I said, "Well, now, if you don't know how much the expenses are, and you don't know how much the travel is, and the overhead and the costs are, then how do you know that $100 is enough?" See, from his point of view, he says, "Well, I want to pay you $100 to go to this school." And I contend that $100 is enough because that's what I want to pay. Well, I guess we could say the same thing about the Ford Crown Victorias. You know, they're charging too much. But, well, how much do we have to pay for labor? And how much do we have for overhead? And how much do we have to pay for transportation costs? And all of a sudden, maybe if we knew what their costs were, maybe the prices that they're charging for their products maybe isn't as out of line as we might think it is. Again, the public policy of most countries in the world is predicated upon a socialist formula, not private property and private enterprise, not from thou shalt not steal and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. It's predicated upon from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, and the abolition of all right to private property. That's public policy. And it produces shortages. And those shortages are translated in food to famines. Not because that there's a physical shortage of food, but because you can't get the food from where you have it to where you need it. And the people who are living where they need it do not have the money to pay to the guy that's got it. And so the guy that is hungry in India says, "You're charging too much." But he doesn't know what it costs to produce it and ship it from Peoria, Illinois to India. And he cannot afford to pay the prices that we Americans have to have in order to sell that stuff in India. And yet when he goes to produce that food stuff over in India, he can't compete, and he can't because of the Green Revolution which has produced seeds, hybridized seeds, genetically modified seeds that are wonderful for the economy of Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa because of the cheap abundance of chemical fertilizers and chemical sprays. But he doesn't have those chemicals available, and when he buys those chemicals, it pushes the food prices so far out of sight that he can't compete with the other local food producers. So it gets down to economy. And the food surplus that we're talking about over here is a food surplus in America. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And the food surplus in America is predicated upon the cheap chemical fertilizers from petroleum, which is coming to an end. Well, we're about out of time, boys and girls. We've got to leave it right there. We'll be back here tomorrow night talking about this thing of famine coming to America by public policy. Next time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.